And we continue now with In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Naomi Oreskes is professor of the history of science and affiliated professor of Earth and Planetary Sciences at Harvard University. She's the author of The Scientific Consensus on Climate Change, and she visits Brookings tonight as part of the Harding Distinguished Lecture Series. But first, we welcome her to In the Moment. Professor Oreskes, thanks for being here.
Oh, thank you for having me.
All right. Where do you want to begin? Let's talk about the word consensus and just begin there, because I know that's something that you're kind of known for among your colleagues is, sort of spreading that word. Where do you want to begin?
Well, that's an interesting starting point. So many people have the idea that science is about proof and that scientists prove things about the world. But from the point of view of history of science, we have to say that's not really quite how it works. Science is a process of discovery, so we know that if scientists are doing their job, there's always the possibility that we will learn new things in the future that might make us revise what we think today, and that's a good thing. That's what we call progress. And so historians of science don't really like to talk about proof in science. We prefer to talk about consensus, that when there's substantial evidence that something's the case, when there's evidence becomes overwhelming, when there really isn't any reason to think that anything is otherwise, then scientists generally come to agreement, and we call that agreement consensus. And it's really crucial to the notion of scientific process and progress, because if scientists couldn't agree, if they were always just arguing forever, then there would be no progress in science. So the idea that scientists can come to a point where we have enough evidence to say, yes, this is really proven beyond a reasonable doubt, it's demonstrated, we believe this to be true, that's what historians like myself refer to as scientific consensus.
So when we speak of climate change as just a layperson, what I'm wondering is how fast is the science sort of changing, new discoveries, kind of coming out? And what's my best entry point as a layperson to keep up with it and figure out what I need to know?
Well, the science really isn't changing very fast. That's the whole point.
Okay.
The basic idea that the Earth's climate is changing because of increased greenhouse gases in the atmosphere, this was already predicted more than a century ago. Scientists started working on it seriously in the 1950s when the use of fossil fuels increased dramatically after World War II, and scientists became concerned that this could be a serious problem going forward. And it was in the late 80s, early 1990s that scientists came to a consensus that, yes, indeed, the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere had increased dramatically. We could measure it directly. We had direct observations, so it wasn't just theoretical or speculative. We could prove that that carbon dioxide came from fossil fuels by looking at its isotope concentration. And indeed, we could also show that the temperature of the Earth was increasing, and it was increasing in ways that were completely consistent with the increase in carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases in the atmosphere.
So do we shift our attention then to what needs to be done next?
Exactly. And this is what's really, to me, very sad about our present situation. So that is what happened in the early 1990s in the administration of President George H.W. Bush. Political leaders and scientists both said exactly what you just said. It's time for us to start thinking about solutions. And so the United States and the rest of the world came together in Brazil in 1992. In Rio de Janeiro, and signed the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change, which said, we have this science, it tells us we have a problem, the problem is not severe yet, but it will become severe in the future if we don't take action now, so we should begin now to do something about this problem. President Bush promised, he made a speech in which he said, we're going to take concrete steps to protect the planet and prevent disruptive climate change, but then things changed. Things got derailed. We didn't take substantial action. And now here we are, more than 25 years later, and we still haven't acted on the scientific knowledge.
What happened? What changed after, we're talking George H.W. Bush?
Well, this is the topic of our book, Merchants of Doubt. It's been made into a film now, and this is what I'll be talking about tonight here in Brookings. There began to be organized resistance, a combination of fossil fuel interests and political ideologues who were opposed to government intervention in the marketplace began to work together to challenge the scientific evidence and to spread a message of doubt to confuse us, to confuse you, to confuse me, to confuse all the people listening to us right now on the radio, to make the American people think that we didn't really know, that the science wasn't settled, and therefore we should not spend money to fix the problem. And what we showed in our work, in our book, Merchants of Doubt, was that the tactics that these people used were the same tactics that had been used by the tobacco industry to try to prevent control of tobacco products.
Give me an example of what a tactic would be that was used by the tobacco industry that you saw repeated.
Key one is the claim that the science isn't settled. So you have scientists working on the problem who have come to a consensus. They say smoking causes cancer and a whole set of other diseases. The tobacco industry says, oh, no, that's not true. The science isn't settled. I want you to meet Joe over here. Joe is a scientist, and he doesn't agree. So they hired, they recruited a small handful of scientists who, for whatever reason, didn't agree. Maybe they didn't agree because they'd been paid off. Maybe they didn't agree because they were working on some other cause of cancer that they thought hadn't got the attention it deserved. The reasons that the scientists get recruited to do this are diverse, but the way they're used is always the same. It's to create the impression of controversy, and they would promote these individual dissenters on radio, on television, in the news media, and someone like yourself, who was not familiar with the science, maybe didn't really know, thought it was reasonable to present, quote, both sides of the issue. So now you would do a radio interview with an oncologist who had worked on the ways in which tobacco causes lung cancer, and then a scientist representing the industry who would say, oh, well, we're not really sure, I don't agree, there's lots of causes of cancer, and the audience would get the impression that the science was very unsettled, we didn't really know, and therefore you may as well just go on smoking.
So there's a false equivalency created by the media.
Well, created by the industry, but using the media as part of, as a kind of tool to promote the strategy.
So how much does the media play into this,
well,
historically
quite a bit,
speaking?
Unfortunately, yeah. I mean, I feel sad. I always feel bad saying this to a journalist like yourself, but the media was a big part of the story. I would say, in a way, the media were victims because the industry exploited. You know, you want to give both sides of stories. You want to be fair. You want to be balanced. Those are all reasonable goals, but the industry exploits that and persuades you that being fair is giving them equal time. But the problem is that it's giving equal time for disinformation.
Right. So let's talk about that a little bit, because as you said, I am a journalist, and I'm not a scientist. I mean, I certainly do my research. But, you know, how do journalists know the difference between, you know, rigorous conversations about science versus this, you know, sort of, you know, creation of false equivalency? I mean, obviously being a good journalist and doing your work, but let's talk deeper about the scientific responsibility to, you know, communicate with those journalists and give them the information that they need to figure it out.
Well, there's two parts. So the second part of what you just suggested, clearly scientists have a responsibility. Scientists need to do more to communicate clearly what I like to say, not just what we know, but how we know it and when we knew it. So what is the evidence? How do we know that climate change is happening? And when did we know this, so that scientists can understand that, in fact, this is actually, by and large, quite settled science, in this case going back to the late 1980s, early 1990s. And I think the scientific community is doing more now. I think increasingly in the last 10 years I've seen a change. So it's definitely moving in the right direction, but it's still not enough. But the journalistic community has to be mindful that disinformation is a real thing, that these strategies are well-honed, and knowing that that's the case, you, in my opinion, shouldn't just be putting somebody on the radio or the television just to, quote, balance a story. You should be going to the National Academy of Sciences or the American Association for the Advancement of Science, places you know are accredited, reputable scientific organizations, and that's where you should go for your scientific data and your scientific arguments, not a think tank, not a trade group, not an industry group. Many times these industry groups have names that make it sound as if they're scientific, like the American Council on Science and Health, for example, is largely a product of the American chemical industry. So you have to not be tricked by these nice-sounding names, but actually go to organizations that you know are genuine scientific organizations, like the National Academy of Sciences. A few years back, the Royal Society in Britain did a really great job. They wrote a book that called Facts and Fictions about Climate Change, in which they explicitly addressed what we knew and also what some of the disinformation about climate change was. The Royal Society has been around since the 17th century. It's one of the most distinguished, reputable scientific organizations in the world. So as a journalist, you could be pretty confident that if the Royal Society is saying this, there's a pretty good chance it's correct.
So what, as a journalist and as, you know, consumers of media and news, what are the let's start with this. As a journalist, what are the conversations we need to be having now on this show and others? We talk to you, and then where else do we go to continue to have those rich scientific conversations?
Well, I appreciate your inviting me, because I do think it's very important for journalists and the American people to understand that we have been victims of a disinformation campaign, and it's a disinformation campaign that has recapitulated what happened with tobacco. And we know that millions of Americans died prematurely because of addictive tobacco products. And it's not to say all of those people would have necessarily quit if they'd had good information, but I think it's safe to say that many of them would have quit sooner, because once good information finally did come out, huge numbers of Americans did quit. And we know that many Americans, even today, you know, with the right help and intervention, are able to quit smoking when they want to. So information does matter, and getting good information to people is really, really important, which is, of course, why I'm talking to you today.
Right, yeah.
I'm here in South Dakota. But the other thing I think is understanding that the basic science is settled allows us to focus on what I think is the really pressing issue now, which is the solutions.
Right.
And there is a genuine debate to be had, because there's more than one way we could try to fix this problem. And we need to have a robust and rich conversation among various people about what strategies we could be following now to solve this problem. Because it can be solved. Climate change can't be prevented entirely anymore. It's too late for that. But there are still many, many things we can do now to move us off fossil fuels and into an energy economy that would be productive, that would generate jobs, and would still allow us to live a good life.
So what are the conversations about solutions that are happening right now, and some of the the stronger arguments that are coming forth?
Well, one of the things we talked about here this morning here at the university was about agricultural responses, things like different forms of ethanol. There are many forms of ethanol that are environmentally damaging, but there are some forms that actually might be quite reasonable. And that's something that in an agricultural community we ought to be looking at, to think about ways in which farmers here can contribute to solutions by growing different possible crops, or by using waste products, agricultural waste products, for biofuels. There's rich opportunities there. Already in Norway today, there's a huge biofuels industry based on forest byproducts. And that's something that a lot of Americans don't know about, but it's creating an economy, it's creating jobs. And we're not actually leading in the United States on biofuels, but we could be. Another area we talked about this morning is wind power. I just went hiking yesterday in the Badlands, mm-hmm. and it seems to me the wind blows just about all the time here in South Dakota. And this is a very windy place. The potential for wind power appears to be quite great. So, and one great thing about wind power, it generates a lot of jobs, and you can't outsource those jobs. In general, renewable energy jobs can't be outsourced. So there's tremendous opportunities for job creation in renewable energy, and that's a conversation that I'd like to, I'd like to hear.
Right. What's your message for South Dakota farmers and producers, who are kind of tuning in and thinking about, what the future of agriculture is?
Well, I'm not an agricultural expert, but I would say to me the answer is wind power, because one of the really interesting things that's happened in Texas now, particularly in West Texas, is that many ranchers and farmers out there have installed wind turbines on their ranches and are now making a profit and adding to their incomes and keeping their children on the farms and on the ranches, because they have a new source of income through wind power. And the key to doing that, this is a little known but important fact, when George W. Bush was governor of California, he signed a bill that it was called a plug and pay system, where anyone who could generate wind power on their ranch or their farm could plug into the grid and sell that power to the grid and be paid for it. And that has made a huge difference both to energy production in Texas and also to the farmers and ranchers. So I don't know the details of farming here in South Dakota, but it seems like that Texas model would be a good one to look at and think about and see if it might be suitable here.
What do you know about, the ability of the grid to handle the wind power? That's another obstacle, isn't it, or challenge?
Well, certainly it's an interesting issue. There's a certain degree of modernization that is needed, and there is an important question about who should be doing that. Is that a private or a public sector responsibility? But again, that would be a great topic to have a radio show about. What would it take to modernize the grid here in South Dakota to absorb wind power and then sell it maybe beyond the state? Because there's a tremendous opportunity for profit here, and it may involve some degree of investment in the infrastructure. But of course, the United States has a great history of investing in infrastructure and making money by doing so. So that's something that we've done before, we know how to do, and we should be able to do it again.
We're having conversations about Keystone XL and building that pipeline. What do those conversations sort of center on?
Well, for me, it's hard to see a positive argument for Keystone XL because it's a fossil fuel infrastructure. There's simply no way we can solve the climate change problem if we continue to build new infrastructure that locks us into using fossil fuels for the next 50 to 100 years. The only way to stop disruptive climate change is to stop using the fuels that produce the greenhouse gases that are driving climate change. So even though I do understand that there's an argument for jobs and building a pipeline, I think there's a much better, longer-term argument for building for jobs and building 21st-century modern technology that will take us into the future in a productive and healthy way.
Sometimes the argument is that the pipeline infrastructure is aging, and for safety reasons, we need to upgrade it anyway because there are already pipelines. How do you address that concern?
Well, I think that's a very silly argument. I mean, a pipeline can be patched. I mean, you know, pipes leak, and we've known how to fix leaking pipes, you know, since the Roman period. So if the issue is that the pipeline needs to be fixed in a few places, then okay, let's fix it. But we fix it while we phase out the use of fossil fuels. A new pipeline is essentially committing us to continuing to use fossil fuels for at least another 50 years. And we know that we cannot do that if we don't expect to see disruptive climate change. And yes, there are jobs in pipelines, but there are jobs in a whole lot of other things too, jobs that are better jobs, more stable jobs, longer-term jobs. And, you know, if people here don't believe that climate change is affecting them, I mean, I just came back from the Black Hills where you can see dead trees everywhere. And it's shocking what's happening to the forests here and in Utah and across the western United States. And this, we know this is related to climate change. The bark beetles are not dying off in the winter the way they used to because our winters are so much warmer than they used to be. So this is a direct climate impact that's affecting South Dakota, Wyoming, Utah, Idaho. You can see it in front of your eyes. I took photographs. I mean, it's very, very shocking. So this is the sort of impact that we're already seeing even now because of our dependence on fossil fuels.
Professor Oreskes, our time is short, but I'm wondering if we could end with this. And for listeners who, you know, feel overwhelmed or feel a sense of hopelessness about some of these things that happen, they don't really know, you know, how they can make a difference just as a person. Obviously, they can vote and have their voices heard. But are there other things that we can do as individuals that sort of move us in what you would consider the right direction?
Well, you know, Bill McKibben says the most important thing you can do as an individual is not to act as an individual, but to join a group or an organization that's working for wind power or that's working for renewable energy jobs. So I do think that Bill's right about that. But at the same time, I also accept that, you know, we do need to feel like there are things we can do as individuals. So it's a stereotype, but it's true. Change your light bulbs. LED light bulbs are like 90% more efficient than incandescent light bulbs, so you will save money in the long run if you put a small amount of investment up front. You can put solar power on your house. I've done that. My electricity in my home is now all solar, and I make a profit off it because I sell the excess to the grid. So there's lots of things you can do as an individual that are good for the world and are empowering, and you can even earn and save money doing it. So change your light bulbs, think about installing solar power. Electric cars are becoming radically cheaper and better by the day. So there's a lot of good things out there that we can do, but ultimately we do have to work together, as you said, to modernize the electricity grid so it can accommodate renewable energy and we can have the energy we need without destroying the future for ourselves and our children.
Harvard professor Naomi Oreskes is the author of The Scientific Consensus on Climate Change and other works. You can see her tonight as part of the Harding Distinguished Lecture Series at 7 p.m. Central at the SDSU Student Union. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Oh, thank you very much.
I appreciate your time.
Good luck with the fundraising.